We need to see the farmer as hero. These are the people who grow most of the food that we eat. And yet they are, in most Western countries, certainly in North America, they're more or less at the bottom of the totem pole. We need to rebuild rural life. As I said, revitalize urban centers and make them once again designed for people, not cars. To create public spaces, affordable housing and rental housing, which I think should be democratically controlled somehow. And we need to reduce, and I'm afraid this is heresy in America, we need to reduce the obsession for owning houses and homes.
That's Julian Darley, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Julian Darley on the post-carbon world. As our lives have become ever more complex, so too has our food chain. Where once people ate food grown fairly close to them, now it is being shipped literally from around the world. From grapes in Chile to water from Fiji, much energy is expended in filling our fridges. These products arrive in containers at ports where they are then loaded onto tractor-trailer trucks for long-haul delivery. This is an unsustainable model. The stress on the planet and its fragile ecology is severe. Changes in climate and energy point to the necessity for rethinking our local economies. There's a huge growth in and popularity of farmers' markets and CSAs, community-supported agriculture. More and more people are thinking and acting locally when it comes to food and life in a post-carbon world. Someone who's looked at these issues is Julian Darley. He's founder of the Post-Carbon Institute, headquartered in Sebastopol, California. He's the author of High Noon for Natural Gas and co-author of Relocalize Now. He spoke at the Renaissance of Local Festival in Lyons, Colorado, in late September 2007.
A quick word about Post-Carbon Institute. A few people who are of a great jocular disposition say, well, it was absurd, it can't be post-carbon because we're full of carbon, aren't we? And it's quite true. And it's not we're advocating sulfur-based life forms such as exist in sort of deep oceanic plumes, you know, volcanic plumes. But I think we understand that it means beyond hydrocarbons, particularly the non-renewable hydrocarbons, and beyond anthropogenic GHGs, greenhouse gases, the ones that we help put out. So that's what the post-carbon part means. And our mission, put rather bluntly, is to get society off fossil fuels as fast as possible, while building sustainable carrying capacity and restoring the environment. And I expect we'll be able to get that done this afternoon, and we can do something else tomorrow. Now, I like to characterize the economy in some of my more whimsical moments as being a bit like a jet fighter, which rushes around all over the place with the afterburners blasting away. And what happens to these fighters and bombers is they go around the place bombing things, curiously enough. That's why they're called bombers and fighters. And they fight things and they shoot missiles, usually at things and people that they can't really see. So it's a jolly brave thing to do. Well, I've long been inspired by an extreme dislike of violence, and I don't like to see what's going on in the world. And part of what drives the work we do is to not only get us off fossil fuels, but try to get us off violence. So the economy that we have is a violent economy, I'm afraid. It's all very clever and productive and produces all kinds of things that we find very valuable and useful, and let's not deny it. We're surrounded by the most extraordinary things here, and buildings and video projectors and all kinds of electronic devices and chairs made out of plastics and metals and so forth, which are all very clever, and we'd all fall on the floor and our trousers would fall down if we didn't have all these marvelous things. But how are they really all made in the end these days? By doing violence to the ground, digging things up out of the ground, and mining, and all kinds of things that we do, which we call part of our economy. And so that's why I liken it to this idea of a jet. So although it produces many more useful things than a jet fighter, in my opinion, nonetheless, it's being done by damaging the ecosystem. And this is no great surprise to anybody here, but I think it's worth thinking about how all this stuff is made. It's almost all of it's dug out of the ground, and much of it very deeply out of the ground. So that's the first part. We need to think about the economy in a different way from the usual way we're thinking about. And It takes an awful lot of fuel, energy, diesel fuel, to go digging great big holes in the ground, deep, large, and so forth, and then to convert all the stuff that we dig out into things that we want, and as, of course, we must then throw most of it in the landfill. And so it's based on a huge energy payback, what is sometimes called energy returned on energy invested. This is a very, very important concept. And without this huge energy profit, civilization and societies will not run the way we want them to. And since we're pretty sure that this huge energy profit, energy payback, is going into decline, we're going to have to do some radical rethinking about how societies are put together. And the other thing about both jet fighters and bombers and also giant tankers, I've got a picture here for the radio audience of a liquefied natural gas tanker. It's a huge thing, almost the size of an aircraft carrier. These things are very difficult to reverse. And, of course, the analogy is with the economy and the huge system that we've built. It is going to be awfully difficult to reverse. In fact, it's darn difficult even to get it going in the right direction. It has an inertia and a momentum all of its own. It wants to keep going in the same way, only more so. The 20th century will be about limits. There are limits to the atmosphere, including carbon sinks, soil, water, oil, natural gas, coal, uranium, large hydro, which often has problems, and limits, of course, to growth itself. There is a sense that this is rather glum. But I'm here to tell you that there is a great deal of good news in these limits, because unrestrained growth is the ideology of cancer. And cancer is a great scourge of this nation and all too many others too. Unlimited growth is not to be found anywhere in nature, because nature has these cycles of birth, growing to maturity, and then something which we don't really like talking about, which is called decline, and then something that even more we won't talk about called death, so I won't even mention it. But that's actually how nature works, you see. You grow to maturity, and then there's decline, and somewhere in there, there's some kind of reproduction going on, which we humans are frightfully good at, so I don't need to talk about that either. This is actually the natural process. So what we've tended to do is remove the idea of death and decline. But unless we see these things as a cycle, we won't be able to understand how the future should be developed from our human point of view. And of course, nature is absolutely full of limits. It's a very, very complex series of complex systems. And nature, over these billions of years, has worked with the limits. And this is what we see around us in terms of the ecological systems we rely on. So these limits, I think, to be seen as fantastic opportunities for the local economy. They are the break that local people and sustainable enterprise has been waiting for. And quite a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is going to be aimed at thinking about how business will look. Because even if many people in the room are not, or maybe you are, engaged in business, there's no doubt about the fact that businesses in one form or another that supply us with so much of what we use, and that will remain true for quite a long time. And what we need to do is surely, during this great transition, this long transition that we're talking about, to help businesses and create businesses which start doing the right thing. And it won't be easy. Many have started, not as many as we would like, clearly, but it is possible. And if we don't do this, then the things that we need to do won't be sustainable, they won't be replicable, as I'll mention later on. Without this, sustainability won't be sustainable. Now, one of the interesting things is, as we all know, North America, the US in particular, is an energy importer, but it is important to understand that being an energy importer is actually a great opportunity to use less energy. If you think about it that way, it actually becomes really exciting. And the more of an energy importer a place is, the better its chances are of using less energy. You can wait and be forced to, or you could take proactive measures and start doing on a planned basis. It's going to encourage us to start producing locally, which is one of the main themes of our work at Post Garden Institute and of this talk. And by these means, will be built strong and resilient local economies of sustainable enterprises and many of the other things that we need to have societies which will last and endure, which at the rate we're going, of course, it's not going to be like that. So this is what we're talking about, changing this. And the other good news is, as many of you are becoming aware, that these limits about which we're talking are going to come even sooner, and they're going to be even better than we thought. As you've noticed, climate change is coming along even faster than the most vigorous predictions, and it does look as if world petroleum production is in this peak plateau phase, and we will know very, very soon whether we're going into this decline. And so this decline, as I suggest, is, I mean, in all seriousness, in a sense, if you are the planet, and in a sense we are the planet, it's this decline of petroleum and the massive amount of energy which humans can expend to wreck the place is actually going to be our salvation. Now, how we navigate this, that could be tricky. So I say, as your fine president has said, to sort of semi-echo his words, bring on the limits. They're coming anyway, so we may as well be honest. So we've got this wonderful opportunity to use less energy and start producing locally, produce these economies of much more sustainable enterprises of production and services which are resilient and sustainable. And so let us look for a second at a picture which I will describe for radio listeners of what I've called the United States, a gargantuan energy importer. The U.S. uses about 100 quadrillion BTUs of energy a year. So this is an awful lot of energy. It's more than any other country. And of that, about a quarter is, slightly more than a quarter, is imported. And that amount of imports is going up all the time because the U.S.'s oil and gas production is going down all the time. And those imports already amount to about 1,000 new atomic power stations. God forbid. It's worth thinking about how energy feels, because it's very hard to understand what, 100 quadrillion BTUs, what on earth is that? It sounds like a sort of dance. It's much easier. We have more of an understanding of nuclear power stations, oddly enough, even though most of us perhaps have never visited one. And in recent months, I've given talks to various states, including California, where I now live, about what grand energy importers they are. And California is doing magnificently. It imports the equivalent of 1.5 million railway cars or railroad cars of coal, which is a 15,000-mile coal train. 15,000 miles of coal a year, effectively. That's an equivalent. That's about two-thirds of the way around the planet at the equator. And that's to supply about four quadrillion BTUs, which is more than half of all the energy that California uses. And recently I had the pleasure of being in Minnesota before that unfortunate bridge collapsed. And Minnesotans are, like several other states in United States, are leading America in their magnificent attempts to be near 100% energy importers, a bit like Japan. I had the great pleasure to be invited to talk to local government planning professionals, and there were several hundred there, and I think I rather shocked them by demonstrating the huge level of imports that Minnesota had. But it had a real galvanizing effect that in the afternoon workshop sessions, people said, right, that's it. No more messing around. We understand the situation. Minnesota's a bit of a cold place, like Canada, where I used to live. We've got a serious problem. And it's true of every industrialized country and every country beyond that. But the more you use, the more serious the situation is, but the greater the opportunity. When the world does appear to be in a peak plateau production phase, it's very clear that when you go to the IEA, the International Energy Agency's website, and you can see there's a section where they show the world oil supply, and it's very clearly in this bumpy plateau. But what's absolutely extraordinary is that world demand, according to the projections, is definitely not in any kind of bumpy plateau. It's jolly well rocketing up. And we can see that world oil supply has touched about 85.5 million barrels a day. But according to the International Energy Agency, who is tasked with trying to understand these things, that demand is supposed to reach nearly 90 million barrels a day by the end of next year. And indeed, it's supposed to almost touch 88 million barrels a day by the end of this year. But looking at the patterns of the production, the extraction of petroleum, it doesn't seem to be any way that this could possibly happen. Now, some people, including very well-meaning environmentalists, have been suggesting over the last few years that we should switch to natural gas. But I wrote the book High Noon for Natural Gas for a reason, and that was that evidence was pointing to the fact that North America was peaking in terms of natural gas production. And so it has. It peaked in 2001. And it's very difficult to bring natural gas in from anywhere else. So as far as North America is concerned, we really have to rely on the natural gas that's produced here. And it's very apparent that natural gas has peaked because there's been an astonishing rocketing up of the number of wells producing this natural gas in the last 10 or so years, such that it's absolutely clear that there'll never be any recovery to former peak levels of natural gas production. And that's a very serious matter for all industrialized countries, but also for America, because of the amount of natural gas which is used for heating and in power stations and in many other things which we currently find very useful. And lest one not want to sort of downgrade this glorious natural gas stuff, if we compare natural gas, the energy in natural gas, with, for instance, baked potatoes, which actually have a lot of energy in them, it's about approximately 10 times as energy dense. So if we've got a natural gas, oil and coal economy, as we have, with this tremendous level of energy density, and then we were to switch to a baked potato economy, we'd have probably about one-fifth or one-tenth the amount of activity. And that should give us pause for thought. We also see, thinking in terms of limits, these extraordinary run-ups in the carbon dioxide emissions, which I'm sure most of the audience will be only too familiar with. But it is quite extraordinary. We're reaching levels not seen for hundreds of thousands of years and possibly not for millions of years. And we understand that there are feedback operations, what are called positive feedback operations, coming into play, which are anything but positive as far as we're concerned in terms of their results. We are playing a dangerous game, and it's not one that we seem to be able to relinquish. And it's very clear, as everybody surely knows by now, that the vast majority of these greenhouse gases which we are causing are emitted by the burning of fossil fuels. And it's worth pointing out that we are the ultimate pyrophiles. We are this pyrophilic creature. We love fire. And we love fire because we spread all over this planet with our great ingenuity and our technology and our fire, a lot of the time to keep warm. We also use it to cook our food. So we are really stuck with fire for a very long time. And so for the moment, during the Great Transition, what we have to do is do a much better job of using as little fire as possible and doing it much better than we've done heretofore. So we see in this wonderful opportunity what a tiny fraction of the current 100 or so quadrillion BTUs that the United States uses, what a tiny fraction is coming from solar and wind. Now, one could shake one's head and moan and groan about this tiny fraction. It's well under 1% of the whole energy mix coming from solar and wind, which are, I think, by far the most promising external energy sources. But by the same token, that is, of course, a great opportunity to do an awful lot more of it. And one of the things that's very clear is that we do not have time to panic. So let us hear no talk of panic. There isn't time for it. We will leave that to future centuries and historians. We, however, need to start planning instead. Part of planning is analysis. And we need to understand that big changes in the energy flow, which is what we're facing, mean big changes in the whole system. The amount of energy flowing in a system is fundamental because ultimately everything depends on it. If you think about, for instance, a creature that has no energy, you will then find yourself describing something we call dead. So this is it. Dead creatures have no energy in them. Well, you know, you can sort of cut them up, and if you have sharp teeth, you can sort of extract the remaining bit of energy, but you know what I mean. Climate change and peak energy mean great uncertainty. And when you build large settlements, which is what we've been doing for at least 9 or 10,000 years, uncertainty is really bad news. And one of the few things that we can be absolutely certain of is, in fact, uncertainty. But that's not much help to us. And in terms of energy, it's becoming very uncertain, unpredictable, to predict the price of energy, especially oil. But eventually there will be uncertainty about the very supply of oil, and we're just not used to that. There will be actual shortages. And they may come in unexpected ways and at unexpected times. So all of this means fundamental change in the way we organize our lives and the economy. And to just glibly say, well, it's fundamental change, that's grand, isn't it? We are going to have to think very carefully about so many things that we've taken for granted. And Post Carbon Institute is very strongly behind the idea of starting with what you've got. Start from where you are. Start with small steps, especially aggregating small steps together. It's a much better way to go for a lot of reasons, especially if you don't have vast resources and don't have control over the governing system. We don't have absolutely no control over the governing system. We have quite a lot of control over the local governing system, local government system. But it's very important to think about what's not going to be lost in peak and to think about what we can control. So in terms of where and how much of the flows we need to think about, we need to think about where we get our energy and materials, because there one day there will be less energy around, and therefore less energy to move our material stuff, and therefore less economic activity. This is, it seems to me, an undeniable fact of Newtonian physics. And so this is going to be something fundamentally new for business and fundamentally new for just about everybody. It's worth, however, saying that although the total amount of global economic activity must needs decline, because especially because of the decline of oil, that doesn't mean that local activity needs to decline, far from it. So once again, the theme is the local, relocalization. And we're looking at a practical vision based on facts and realistic projections. We will need to ask what the challenges are. They will be very serious in many cases. But what are the significant opportunities for those who can be ready for them? And we do need to gain a much deeper understanding of our critical resources, especially food, water, energy. And in these challenges, there genuinely will be opportunities for local business and local people, especially in terms of rebuilding the provisioning system so that we get our essential daily needs from as locally as possible. Climate and energy uncertainty has profound implications. We must ask new questions, especially where do our profits really come from? What are they, in fact? And in a sense, profit is surplus energy. And if you want to think about sustainable profit, where can it come from? There is only one place, and that's the sun. And I think that's a very interesting notion, that we are allowed to have some profit. It's not that we'll just get rid of it. Our civilizations will collapse without profit. We get an enormous amount of energy every day from the sun, but it has to be shared out. So we can't just grab it all, and we won't be able to either. And when you think about it, all other profit really just comes from strip mining. It comes from digging into the earth and tearing it out. And we know that's going to change. And anybody who's in business or anybody who runs a household knows that revenue has to cover operating expenses, and you shouldn't be taking it out of your capital, because that is not sustainable. So the thought that comes from this is that we actually need to manage on our solar income. What comes to us from the sun every day, or indeed comes out of the sky. It means sustainability will mean living on your earnings, not your capital, managing on your solar income, or our solar income. And that will include wind and tides and solar PV and farm output. Up till now, in the last couple of hundred years, we've got used to using fossil fuels, which is ancient sunlight. And we've used this to boost our carrying capacity and build a high energy infrastructure of which we're inordinately proud. But that way of life is coming to an end. Now, a word about carrying capacity, which is a very important concept. There are several very important concepts. Ecological footprinting is another one, but I think that's much better understood. Carrying capacity can be defined as the maximum number of organisms that can use a given area of habitat without degrading the habitat and without causing social stresses that result in the population being reduced. And essentially, how can we manage with the ecological system as it is without ruining it? For humans, the carrying capacity is affected by many complex factors, including energy inputs, particularly fire, both external and internal, as it were, internal combustion engines. It's affected by technology, agriculture, and culture itself. These mean that carrying capacity is not that easy to calculate. But simply put, we mustn't use more resources than the carrying capacity of a place can bear. I think it would be a very good idea to try to determine the carrying capacity that would be applicable for a sustainable region, for a sustainable locale. It's not easy to do, and there isn't an absolute number, but I think it would be a very helpful thing to do. And as has been mentioned earlier on, water is a very important constraint in the American West, and it's a very important constraint on carrying capacity. Speaking of other limits, we have borrowed, clearly, sunlight from the past, not giving a very good return, I don't think, on these things. We, of course, now also taking the environment from the future and from other species. The challenge, one of the major challenges, is can we imagine and achieve a steady state economy that actually lives within our means? Well, you'll be gratified to hear, of course, there's a solution. And the solution is reduce consumption and produce locally. That's what all the other animals manage to get their consumption to such a level that they can meet it with their local production, their local harvesting. It's going to require a great energy transition. And we call this whole process, this long transition, relocalization. There are many reasons why we use the word re in front of localization. We can think of so many of the words that we're going to need to look to: restore, reuse, recuperate, recover. There are many, many words beginning with re, which are useful keys to what we'll need to do. And in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways, we are going to be going back to earlier techniques. I remember somebody said to me when I was given a lecture in Edmonton in Canada, said, we're not going backwards. I mean, we can't go backwards, can we? And well, of course we are. I mean, because to keep going forwards with so much energy requires an increase in that energy if you've built that system, and we just won't have it. So the key will be to find the best bits from history, the best bits from the past, and use those and not somehow manage to use the worst bits. I very much fear that we could do the latter, but we don't want to do that. We should be trying to get our daily needs from as locally as possible. We should be inverting the conventional global logic such that we put local first, then regional, then national, and only finally international. It's not that the larger schemes, the larger needs for trading will go away. It's just quite clear we won't have the energy to do it in the way that we've got used to. It's been pretty devastating for many people in the globe anyway, but we will be forced to invert the logic and put local first.
You're listening to Julian Darley on the Post-Carbon World. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And the sooner we do that, the easier our task will be. And this means that we need a local and regional renaissance, the theme of this conference and the theme of this talk. We shall need to reframe many things, to frame our thinking and planning in terms of reducing consumption and producing locally. This has a radical effect on the way that we will think about the structures of our society. We will need very different kinds of innovation, if you like, innovative innovation. The kind of innovation we have now is rather sort of old-fashioned innovation, in a sense. We will need both new and old thinking, much experimentation, and we will need to think rather in terms of responses and solutions, because it's misleading to think too much in terms of solution, because this is not 2 + 2 = 4. It's not solving a quadratic equation. This is a very complex situation with a lot of emergent properties, and it's very dynamic, and things that we do today will affect what happens tomorrow. And so it won't be possible to simply say, well, we must do this, this, and this, and that's that. We need to reframe our current economic thinking. I've spoken to some extent about that already. We need to start, as it were, seeing energy. I know you can't actually see energy, but we do need to sort of see energy, not just money. We need to think in terms of energy budgets, not just dollar budgets. And one of the absolute keys to what we are going to do is shorten our supply chains. The flat opposite of what we've been doing for the last 50 to 100 years. We'll need to think about scale, about networks, about collaboration. We'll need to think about the physical size of projects. They will generally be smaller. There may be some exceptions, but generally that's the direction that we should be going in. We'll need to think much more about networks of distributed suppliers. And the need for middle people will increase. I'll mention this again perhaps later on, but the middle man, as was called, did not get a very good time. Certainly when I was in my childhood and adolescence, there was much talk about how bad the middle people were. But as it turns out, we will need to see the regrowth of the middle person. They turn out to be very useful in a much more distributed and local supply chain. Scale of knowledge. Knowledge of networking, the small, is very different from having a small number of very large projects. If you think about solar photovoltaics, for instance, having millions of those is very different from having one or two giant coal or nuclear stations. They're very different kinds of problems. And we shouldn't underestimate the engineering challenges of trying to network these together. Electricity is absolutely vital stuff, we've discovered, but it's very curious, and power engineering is not something that most people understand. Shorter supply chains will need lots of careful planning. One of the reasons why we've become comfortable with this globalized economy is that it actually makes lots of things much easier, believe it or not. But shorter supply chains will take a lot more careful planning, and we'll need to be much more engaged with them than we have been heretofore, these supply chains, that is. Collaboration will need to trump competition, and there will be extraordinary needs for communications as well in order to make that collaboration work well. We'll need a new age of sharing. Again, sharing requires extraordinary levels of communication which will surprise us. There are limits to high tech, and although high tech won't go away, and especially in terms of communication, I think we're going to need it, we also need to be aware of the limits to high tech, which we're all heavily reliant on, or virtually all of us. What we will need is local technology. We will need innovation in processes for research and development and manufacturing and distribution, which will help us rebuild this local economy, these local supply chains. And we will need retail and middle-level wholesalers. And we'll need to help us be much more flexible and to shorten these supply chains. And we can't just, of course, switch the economy from strip mining to a sustainable one, even if it were generally agreed that that's what we needed to do, and there's no hint of that just yet. We will need lots of what I call non-investment money, angel money, research money, philanthropic money, to help us discover what to do, because we will make lots of mistakes on this path. It's just unfortunate. We need to try to learn from each other and share our mistakes, which is often embarrassing, but we'll need to do that. And we will need to invest in a lot of basic as well as applied research to help us discover what to do. So people out there who are scientists and academics and others and researchers, there is the possibility, if there are the resources to pay for it, of an extraordinary resurgence in some very useful and very important research. But I stress, there will need to be the resources to pay for it. Critical thinking is something that's not been terribly high on the agenda for an awfully long time. Socrates and Plato and Aristotle were rather fond of it, and I am too. And I think it's rather a wonderful, enjoyable thing to do. But not every high school student apparently agrees with this. But this will change. Part of the importance of critical thinking is to help us to understand that we need to dramatically extend our planning horizons. This will require much deeper analysis. We will need to change the way we think and approach the economy. And I'll say a few words, because it's all very well just to throw these things out there. Where I can, I'll try and give some examples of that. The challenge is to learn to think systemically, particularly with so many uncertainties. And long-range planning has always tended to be a linear process. Instead, we need to think in terms of scenarios, in terms of redundancy, resilience, responses, experiments. We'll need to be proactive and responsive, flexible, innovative, and research-oriented. This is a big shift away from the way that we're used to thinking about the world. And we will need both new knowledge, but also pre-petroleum knowledge. We'll need new and, as it were, old ways of doing and being. Now, to speak of supply chains and move from analysis to action, we will need to think very carefully about what's coming in, what's going out, where it's going to, where it's coming from. That will help us in reducing the enormous amounts of waste and in shortening the supply chains. And we'll need to think about how we can shorten these supply chains quickly. Now, one has to be honest, the economy is just not set up to do this. But where we can think about ways of doing this kind of analysis and ways in which we can shorten the supply chain quickly, there will be tremendous opportunities for people who are operating in the local economy. It's going to be a very serious question to think about how will money flow to those working for sustainability. It's been very tricky in most cases up till now. There's a little bit of tide turning here, but it's not really the great flood that we need. Money is sucked out of local life and into global speculation, so that the current economy is just not ready for sustainability. What we need to do is keep money circulating in the locale. And some ways of doing this is if we have our own local transport and we have some control over that, we need local investment in local production to consider local mutual funds, local banks and credit unions, local stock markets, which are currently in most places not even legally possible, unfortunately, local currencies, local pensions, local healthcare. One hears from the presidential candidates, I think the most unfortunate kinds of remediation to the healthcare system, just talking about insurance and so forth. There is a huge possibility if one were able to go back to a system of local healthcare delivery and tie that to pensions and retirement money, there's an incredible bounty of money in there which then could be reinvested back into the locale. And this is not something that one can just do at a tiny scale. There needs to be a certain medium scale, medium to large scale indeed, to this. Otherwise you won't get the resilience and people won't have the confidence in the system, but it is possible. Now, to speak of the post-carbon economy, this means more people taking part in primary production and finished goods. It will mean fewer people taking part in the current knowledge economy and many more in agriculture. This is going to be a worry for many people, because if you spent your whole life in the knowledge economy and you're expected to take part in the primary production economy, you may be very challenged. You may not have the skills for it. And we need to recognize that this will be disquieting and to put in place measures to help allay those kinds of fears and actually help people develop skills where they can that will be helpful in this way. There are huge opportunities for education, but I don't think the traditional education, or I should say conventional education rather than traditional, conventional education, which is educating people to take part in the global economy, it's hard to see how that has great opportunities. We need to reinvest in vocational education, in apprenticeships and trade skills. I think we need to rebuild light industry and even some regional heavy industry. I know we need to be careful about this. It's messy and unpleasant. But we must start making things again. And many of the things we need to make are made out of metal. Where's that metal going to come from? Transport is obviously tremendously important, including here in Colorado, which does face a very large petroleum import situation. And we should be trying to go back, where we do need mechanized transport, to metal rails and electric vehicles. One of the ways that will help us get there is through car share organizations, and I know that Boulder already has one, and I applaud them for that. We in Sebastopol have taken bold steps very recently to start something called a solar car share, where our aim is that all the vehicles in it will either be directly electric or else hybrids, or else fueled with, we hope, locally made ethanol or locally made biodiesel. I'll say a little more about the grim situation with industrial biofuels. We will need some liquid biofuels, but they should be made locally. We need to build our lives locally once again. And one of the most dramatic things that I could say to you today is that our home, our work, our education, our culture should all be within 5 minutes' walk. Now, that's a pretty astonishing thing to say in North America. I've lived on and off in North America for 20 years now. I know that may well sound absurd to anybody listening to this. But in a sense, as we go into the great energy decline, what else is there? In a sense, it's absolutely, totally logical to think that we should be starting to work within these five-minute walking zones. It's tremendously democratic. It's good even for those who can't bicycle. I love bicycling, but not everybody can. But almost everybody can get around within about a quarter of a mile. That's about how far you can walk. So it is the way forwards. And some architects have recognized this, but not many yet. It's going to be a real challenge. We're also going to see the return of manual work. Automation has thrown millions, billions of people out of work in the last 50 to 60 years, and a lot of that automation is going to go away. Now, I'm not suggesting that one should just simply throw it out, even conceptually. I mean, we can't throw it out physically, but even conceptually, we will need automation. It's interesting doing the work that we've been doing on our energy farms and energy gardens, how difficult it is to process some things and how long it takes, for instance, to process apples and how fast it can be done with a small electric motor. So there will be a need for automation, but as we go into the post-carbon economy, we will need to think very carefully about where that automation is and think carefully about where we can use human muscles once again. Local farming needs to become the engine of the economy. It once was, it will have to be once again. We will need to support and grow a huge network of small to medium scale locally owned farms growing food, fuel, fiber, feedstock, fertilizer, forest. We're developing the Energy Farms Network to help new and existing farms do exactly that. And we've begun in the last few months the Energy Gardens Network. And indeed, we've had a showing of an open day of the first energy garden today, which is in Sebastopol. One of the things that we've learned doing this Energy Farms Network and the Energy Gardens Network is that what we should be concentrating on is trying to reduce waste to zero, and where we can, either returning the waste to natural systems or, where possible and where sensible, extracting that energy to make gaseous and liquid and solid fuels. That is the real work I feel that we're going to be seeing in terms of energy farms and energy gardens, but we shouldn't kid ourselves. We will need to grow some stocks, some feedstocks, for making liquid biofuels. But I stress that we should be doing that locally, wherever possible. The industrial biofuel situation is an absolute disaster. It's a disaster in America, and it's a really grim disaster in many other places in the world, especially in terms of terrible habitat destruction. As with everything else, if we want energy, we should get it locally. Our soil is in a grim situation. We need to not just save our soil, we need to start rebuilding our soil. We need to stop building on farmland, and we need to reverse the rural to urban to suburban flow that's happened. What I've coined this marvelous term, which I'm sure you're all going to love, it's called de-donutification. Isn't that splendid? What we need is dense urban centres and workable rural areas, probably with villages at the heart of the rural area, because I have great fears for how the rural situation is going to work out. Although I was born in London, I was brought up in a relatively rural area of South Bucks, and we now live in Sebastopol, which is an agricultural rural area of California. So I see this, I grapple with this daily. We need, many people need to move back to farming. That won't be easy because not everybody knows how to do it. We need clearly to save small family farms and rejuvenate them. We need to see the farmer as hero. These are the people who grow most of the food that we eat. And yet they are in most Western countries, certainly in North America, they're more or less at the bottom of the totem pole. We need to rebuild rural life. As I said, revitalize urban centers and make them once again designed for people, not cars, to create public spaces, affordable housing and rental housing, which I think should be democratically controlled somehow. And we need to reduce, I'm afraid this is heresy in America, we need to reduce the obsession for owning houses and homes. Now, I spoke of challenges. Band-aid approaches just aren't sustainable. We need major systemic change. We need large changes in land use. There will be huge resistance to this, not just in America, but in many other countries. There will need to be big philosophical changes. There will also be resistance to this in many English-speaking countries, which don't much like learning about philosophy, I'm afraid. Many businesses, organizations, cultures, societies in the current paradigm will be in great difficulty. We want to help people and societies not fall into the negative category. Now, another difficult thing that I'm going to say is that the prices of energy and food are too cheap. Now, all politicians, and perhaps many of you listening, think that the prices of energy and food are too expensive. But as long as the prices of food and energy are too low, it's going to make it almost impossible to have a relocalized economy. It's making it very difficult already for producers of solar energy, including wind energy, to compete with coal and so forth. The prices are just too low. And it's the same thing with farmers. If you want farmers to stop going out of business, especially small family farms, then pay them more money for their food. It's darn hard work, and they've been driven to the wall by the cheap prices of petroleum-driven food and also globalized organized food. We have to begin to pay fair and decent prices for food and energy if the system is to be sustainable. It's actually key to this ability to produce locally, and it's also, it'll help us to reduce consumption. And it'll also mean access to land and resources for all. Without fair prices, sustainability is just not sustainable. And for people who say, well, it's going to be terrible for the poor, it will be terrible for the poor if they don't have access to land. But if you think about this, what's the price of a potato when you're about to eat it? It's irrelevant. If you're hungry and you're growing potatoes and lettuce and tomatoes and grains and crops in your garden, and you just walk 20 feet to pick those crops, then it doesn't matter what they cost. You need to eat. You don't eat dollar bills, even our fine new carbon cash, unless we make it on rice paper, which is a thought. So yes, no easy answers, but much to think about. Many things to do in a practical way, but some of the things not to do in any way, I think, are the hydrogen economy, which has got so many problems associated with it. We're in what I call carbon sequestration Valhalla now. We think we're going to build new coal-fired power stations and then extract the carbon that comes out from them, forgetting for a moment the lunacy and the devastation of all the coal extraction. There was a government hearing in Washington, D.C. relatively recently that we reported on for global public media, and the most senior government representative, research representative there, suggested that carbon sequestration wasn't going to be a serious force until 2045. That's about 40 years from now. So I think we should turn our eyes away from coal and carbon sequestration and think about other more natural methods of sequestering carbon. I'm highly in favor of sequestering carbon, but not so that we can do more coal. There is quite reasonably a backlash growing against industrial biofuels, but they're for the reasons that I've outlined. They're absurdities, they're destroying rainforest habitat, they're causing a great run-up in the price of grain costs, which are affecting especially poor people, and they're a bad idea. To the extent that we do biofuels, we need to do them locally. And so-called clean nuclear, one of the ugliest oxymorons I've ever heard of. Thank you. We're going to have to fight this one. Nuclear is coming back. It's having a grim way, like a hydra-headed creature, of coming back. And it's even being touted by some Greens and environmentalists. And I urge my fellow environmentalists not to embrace nuclear. There's no such thing as clean nuclear. It's all filthy, just like coal. And it's dangerous. And the breakdown products are going to be with us for hundreds of thousands of years. And we've no idea how to deal with them, even now. Not to mention the nuclear proliferation, the weapons proliferation. And civilian nuclear has always been an excuse for military nuclear. But in all of this, we shouldn't be driven by desperation or haste. It's going to be very bad for planning. So how can we help? There are many sensible things which currently don't make economic sense, and we need to make them make economic sense. It's terribly difficult for local producers to get started in the current economic paradigm. We're going to have to do everything we can to help local producers during this long transition of relocalization. We're going to need subsidies. Yes, subsidies can be good when they're done for the right thing. Things like the feed-in tariff, which Germany has done so brilliantly to help solar and wind. We're going to need incentives, regional and community support, local economic zones, local currencies. Even the dreaded tariffs may be necessary. Now, I know many of these things are tricky and tariffs have a long and difficult history. We will need to consider all kinds of things. We will also require extraordinary collaboration. As I've said, the band-aid approaches just aren't sustainable. We need systemic change. And part of that systemic change will be job creation on a vast scale. Local manufacturing, manufacturing of energy machines, especially wind turbines, solar photovoltaics, two areas in which America used to lead the world and certainly doesn't now. We will need solar thermal devices which just heat hot water using the sun's rays. Batteries. There are very few places in America making the kinds of batteries which will be needed to make electric cars work in a good way. As I've mentioned, local biofuels need to be grown and processed, and especially understanding that we should be interrupting the waste stream to wherever we can in that process. We'll need to manufacture green building materials. We'll need less chemicals for cleaning and so forth. That means more simple tools, which could be made locally, and more simple chemicals, which could be made locally, and more jobs for more local people. Less global energy means much more of the production pie for locally owned businesses. But we will need to develop and nurture local talent in ways that we've been very poor at in the global world. We must bring back apprenticeships. These things have been driven away, and they are absolutely vital for helping people learn how to be very skilled, as we'll need to be. So I've mentioned education. Great opportunities there in new kinds of education. There are some examples from business, not as many as we would like. Interface. Mondragon is very interesting. It's the world's largest co-op. Very important. Mondragon, in its approximately 50-year history, very early on created its own bank. And I think this is very important, to get control of your money. We should be making, more generically, making paper without trees and finding ways of using less paper. In our energy garden, we've been growing KNAF, and we're encouraging more people to grow KNAF. It looks like a very interesting trough for displacing forests and making paper out of KNAF, which can be grown as a row crop. And there must be many local suggestions. There are many local possibilities here in Colorado. It's quite blessed with many possibilities for renewable energy and for, as it were, renewable business. The benefits of relocalization, and there will be many, less economic polarization, less people earning a vast fortune at the top and virtually nothing at the bottom, which is a very strong indicator of poor health and poor longevity and so forth. It will be an opportunity to rebuild community. There will be, in my opinion, less crime, especially as we see community cohesion increasing and more jobs occurring. There will be better food. The food that comes from the industrial global petroleum system is terrible. There will be more active culture, better health, I believe, the return of public service, the return of the idea of common good. Life, I think, will be better. And I want to say that the return of the local is inevitable, and there is no alternative. How can you find out more about this? Globalpublicmedia.com is a place where you can go and hear interviews with many of the people who are at the forefront of this work. It's up to us, but it's not up to us just as individuals. We need to think of ourselves in groups. At the group level, that's anywhere from 2 to 20 to 200 million people. It is at the group level that the answers and solutions and responses really lie. And that's going to mean an extraordinary level of working together. And I believe that if we are able to work together, if we are able to collaborate so much more, especially at the group level, and build these new infrastructures and recuperate some of the old ones, then we will have a much, much better chance of making the 21st century somewhere worth living in, instead of the future as it's looking like, which looks distinctly grim. So that's the upbeat message. It's a very practical message. I think we need to get on with it, and it will be wonderful for all of those that want to join us in doing this. I think it will be very invigorating, and it will be, in places, actually a great deal of fun. Thank you very much.
That was Julian Darley on the post-carbon world. He spoke at the Renaissance of Local Festival in Lyons, Colorado, in late September 2007. Julian Darley is the founder of the Post-Carbon Institute, headquartered in Sebastopol, California. Their website is postcarbon.org. That's postcarbon.org. This program is produced by AR, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Michael Pollan, Naomi Klein, John Pilger, Angela Davis, Tariq Ali, Amy Goodman, and Howard Zinn. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR so you don't miss a single program, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Julian Darley on the Post-Carbon World, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Michael Brownlee and Boulder Valley Relocalization. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet, Frontpieces of Africa. Ali Lightfoot is our editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bob Dylan, All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. The thief, he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. All along the watchtower, princes kept the view. While all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching,